Well, this week is probably going to be one of those weeks where we're running through the whole thing. It's going to be a very busy week. A lot going on in Washington State, wouldn't you say?
I would say so.
You're listening to Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. My name is Sam, and joining me today is Becky. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Sam.
So last night we had the honor of attending the wedding of Erica and Cy up in Seattle, Erica being the president of Seattle Atheists, and I had a pretty good time. How about you?
I definitely did. You know, as an adult, it's rare that I get to attend really large celebratory weddings, and it was just a really amazing job that Erica and Cy did, bringing together people from such diverse backgrounds and having no religion in this life-affirming ceremony.
You know, honestly, it never... Yeah, you were actually in the ceremony, if I remember.
Yes,
right.
I was part of the wedding party.
I was kind of there. I should remember that. Honestly, the religion or lack thereof didn't really enter into me. It was just kind of a very cool evening. On the other hand, tomorrow... is it tomorrow or is it Tuesday?
Tuesday,
it is
February
Tuesday.
10th.
Tuesday, February 10th at the Clark County Public Service Building at 1300 Franklin Street, Vancouver, Washington. That's the Vancouver to the south of us, not the Vancouver to the north of us.
The Vancouver in the United States.
Yeah. Well, this is basically a rehash of what I did over my summer vacation in 2014. Once again, somebody in a county in Washington State is trying to have In God We Trust, the unfortunate nation's motto, put up in their county chambers, I believe.
Yeah, it's Councillor Tom Mielke, and he, again, is working with the In God We Trust, Inc., or In God We Trust America, Inc., organization, which is an outfit run by one lady that really has this mission to put In God We Trust in every municipal building, municipal, school, any kind of government building.
Well, unlike the last guy up here in Pierce County, at least this one is saying this is the organization he's working with and not pretending it's his own idea that he just came up on his own at one time when he was in the bathroom.
Right.
Yeah, fantastic. So, on Tuesday, there will be an E Pluribus Unum rally for unity, opposing In God We Trust in Clark County. And there's a lot of groups of, there's a lot of people who are going to be there. CFI Vancouver Skeptics, the Portland Chapter of Freedom from Religion Foundation, Freethinkers of Portland State University, the Americans United for Separation of Church and State Columbia Chapter, and CFI Portland. Also, Humanists of Washington, which,
we know a little bit about.
Know a little bit about. Again, once again, I am the president of that organization, and Becky is on the board. So it's a rally get-together to meet in front of the building and oppose the idea of putting, like I said, our unfortunate national motto, one that excludes rather than includes, up on the wall in county chambers.
Yeah, the rally's going to be at 9 a.m. outside the building, and then we'll head in at about 9:30. The meeting starts at 10, the meeting where this resolution will be considered. And folks that are residents of Clark County are really encouraged to speak in public comment at the council meeting. There's no telling how long this is going to be. I think that the local newspaper, the Columbian, actually has an op-ed that is quite supportive of our position on this, that, hey, yeah, it may be our national motto, but there's really no need for it. This is being pushed by religious interests. It is divisive. There's no need. There are also a few organizations that have put out action alerts in favor of this motto.
There's always those folks.
So you know, we'll see how that goes.
Is it the national motto? Of course it is. It was passed as a reference, you know, as basically we are scared of communism message, which is kind of ironic considering the evolution of Russia since. It seems like if we're still worried about Russia, maybe we should drop it. I think somebody told me that the other day. I should probably give credit to that. It is the national motto, but it's a national motto born of the tradition of basically trying to enforce Christian values whenever people feel it's appropriate, even though we do not live in a religious nation. We live in a secular state. Individuals practice religion. The government does not. And it's time people remembered that.
So there are folks that are being encouraged to write to the Clark County Council members with your position on this. And, well, I would certainly encourage us to consider a more deeply rooted American motto, E Pluribus Unum. That's what the rally is being called.
Yeah. And it's really a much better one.
It is. It's Latin for out of many, one.
Yeah. And hey, it's Latin, so religious people should like it. Well, at least certain kinds of religious people who happen to be related to the religious people who are pushing this In God We Trust thing.
Yes.
Because last time we did this here in Pierce County, you know, they were saying it's inclusive of all, you know, it's inclusive of all religions. It's like an inclusive statement. We don't understand why anybody would have a problem with this. I mean, atheists obviously worship themselves. And so every time we tried to say, well, maybe we should go with something a little bit more inclusive, or maybe we should come up with something that makes more sense, suddenly it's stop being about just any particular god and became about one very specific god. Every time anybody pushes In God We Trust, they mean one very specific, one very male, one very desert religion-y kind of god and no other.
Indeed.
And, you know, I may be speaking at this rally, I may be speaking in the chambers, but I'm not a citizen of Clark County, and my preference is always that people who are of that county speak, because those are the people who are going to get the most purchase, which is why, you know, I go nuts whenever something like this happens in Pierce County, where I am a citizen. But I love reading the press. I don't... The press has been very good. Even up here in the Tacoma News Tribune, who I've never really in the past been a fan of, has been staunchly in favor of, hey, maybe being a little bit more inclusive in government and maybe not wasting time on these stupid pennants that religious jerks can put on their caps in order to get the votes of the ignorant.
To make themselves feel good, pat themselves on the back,
right.
At least look ostensibly pious.
But I did say... I did say, you know, that when you put In God We Trust, you're basically insulting everybody who isn't a Christian. I did say that, and that was a point that I had made, and I love that comment. I ended up loving that comment because of the responses it got from religious, you know, from specifically religiously conservative folks on your usual blogs and your usual news website.
Oh, we're talking the comment section here.
Oh, yeah, I love it. Well, if Mulvey thinks that that's an insult, why didn't he come up to me and I'll show him what an insult looks like? And I'm like, wow, I wish you were nearby, because challenge accepted.
So there's going to be a rumble in the county council chambers.
Yeah, it's like, hey, maybe I don't want my government insulting me is a little bit different than I can't handle insults. Let me tell you, folks... I know what an insult sounds like, and I'm not so bad at them myself. Sometimes accidentally, which makes me kind of a jerk.
But do you know what an insult feels like, Sam?
Mostly.
Okay.
A little more than I'd like. So, you know, between Darwin Day on Saturday and this on Tuesday, for the atheism, humanism, free thought community in Washington State, this is going to be an action-packed week. And you may be hearing from us on the podcast feed at askanatheist.tv. Before next Sunday, just to keep track of stuff.
Speaking of Darwin Day, there's actually a really cool resolution that you can encourage at the federal level. There's resolutions being considered in the Senate and in Congress to acknowledge the impact that science has had by recognizing Darwin Day.
Absolutely.
I think the American Humanist Association is promoting that.
So we've got an email. This is Jim from Pasco, Washington, who writes, I recall one of you, I think it was Sam, indicated that he suffers from depression. I've been hospitalized twice in the last 6 weeks with severe depression. I'd like to start a support group in the Tri-Cities area for freethinkers who are also coping with this and other mental or emotional disorders. We do have a chapter of Recovering from Religion, of which I am a member, but I feel as though I need something a little extra beyond recovering from religion. Any thoughts or resources you can point me to would be greatly appreciated. You remember properly.
It was you, Sam.
It was me. And
it is you?
It is actually me on an ongoing basis. It's not, you know, it's the kind of thing you treat. It's not necessarily the kind of thing you cure. And I'm still going through it, you know, of course. I actually don't know. I think Recovering from Religion does have some resources for stuff like this on, you know, for basically dealing with depression and other issues from a non-religious basis. But I've I'm not really too familiar with them.
I think what this really brings up is you can have a support group recovering from religion that maybe deals with depression from a perspective of leaving religion or some of the religious influences that that influence your struggles.
Yeah.
But of course, people that suffer from any kind of thing or struggle with any kind of a mental or emotional business, it may come or it may not come from religion or from a religious root. But it's really important to be able to have that outlet in a non-religious context. So I think one of the most important things that recovering from religion has done is start the Secular Therapist Project.
That was what I was thinking of, yeah.
So it's not necessarily a support group, but maybe having that circle or advertising that circle within the different meetups can be a really powerful thing.
Yeah, I mean, personally, dealing with this with me has been, it has transcended my, it started before I started getting involved in the atheist community in any meaningful way. And so I've sort of dealt with it in my own way. But I do have people I talk to. I have my quote-unquote depression buddy who I talk things over with. It's really important to have somebody else to talk to for a head check. And so I'm really interested in something like this, and I want to know how it works out. And I want to spread the word that there's a need for this in the community. That's when I lack data myself, that's the best thing I can do, is I could just get the word out there and say, hey, guys, if you know anything about this, if you can talk about this, if you've got something like this in your community, if you're near Pasco, Washington, and you know something about this, this is the time to speak up. This is the time to get together, because there are people who need it. And it's more than just me. So
one of the ways that, for instance, one of the local groups here, Seattle Atheists, has dealt with these kinds of things is say, hey, you know what, we're going to start a discussion group, or we're going to start an atheists in sobriety group. It might just be two people, and there might be someone who volunteers to be a facilitator who may be in recovery or who may not be. But having that out there, you'll have people that drop by or drop in and out. And it might take them 8 weeks of seeing a weekly meeting pop up, but they might join you.
And I think the results are definitely going to be worth it. You're listening to Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jonathan Tweet, author of a book regarding evolution for preschoolers. This is going to be a fun one.
Billy, I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it'll explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
48 hours, 24 hours, 10 minutes to go.
The motorcade appears to have stopped, and yes, it appears as though the governor is getting out now. It's hard to see. My God, the rain it's coming down in sheets. I've never seen anything like this. There must be tens of thousands of people out here right now. The streets are shut down. Okay, it appears the governor is making his way toward the convention center. No one knows what he's going to say. The crowd is pushing forward through the storm. The Secret Service is struggling to hold them back. A wave of people are rushing toward the candidate. My God.
0. For your consideration, we present Convention and its subject, the nominee, ANNEXradio.com, now on iTunes and Stitcher.
Looking to buy or sell a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, or surrounding areas? Demand a professional and call Don Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 or visit dndrealty.ca and discover how he works with you to achieve your goals, save you time, and protect your investment. Don Summers of Professional Realty Group. It's time you hired a professional.
Ask an Atheist may have gone on the road, but we're not making big bucks.
We still need to keep the lights on, and 95% of our costs are for airtime alone.
That's why we need your contributions.
If you've got something to advertise, consider Ask an Atheist in your ad budget.
Our listener Peggy said it best. Step up and contribute to keep secular voices on the air. For $5, you could have a latte. or a moment of science.
Take on Peggy's challenge and contribute today.
For details, go to askanatheist.tv or contribute directly via PayPal to paypal@askanatheist.tv.
Jonathan Tweet has been a professional game designer for over 25 years, working on games such as Dungeons & Dragons and Magic the Gathering. His knack for imaginative storytelling spurred the creation of Grandmother Fish, a book designed to teach the concept of evolution to preschoolers. How are you doing, Jonathan?
Really great, thank you.
Fantastic. So, what got you started on this project?
Well, I've got a daughter who's 20 years old, and when she was very little, I thought, like us all parents do, I wanted to tell her, you know, what the world is about and where we come from and what have you. And so, you know, I tried explaining evolution to her, and it got me thinking, how do you explain evolution to very young children? And so I've been noodling on that for 15 years, and finally last year figured it out. And so now here's my book.
So your daughter, in talking about the book, actually stated that she grew up with you telling her all sorts of stories and creation myths from around the world, but that this creation story is the one that stuck with her. What's your feeling on the process of evolution being regarded as a creation story?
Well, I'm not really afraid of that. I know some people don't like the idea of a story, but we evolved to tell stories and understand things as stories. And the problem with evolution is that it really isn't the kind of story that people evolve to understand. Like, we understand stories about people we like trying to do things and facing obstacles and overcoming those obstacles and achieving their goals. And evolution is all about miraculous things happening with nobody trying to make them happen. And so it's a real tough story to tell to children. It doesn't have like a little girl going on an adventure or anything. So I did try to make it sort of feel like a creation story in that you know, it's heartwarming. It has sort of a pattern. It tells the little kid where they come from. And I think if we can make evolution feel adorable and wonderful to kids, then they'll want to buy into it.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that process coming up with the storyline?
Yeah. So, as a game designer, I've always been trying to figure out, how do you get people to engage in an idea? How do you get their imagination to, you know, reach out and grasp a new idea or think about a new world or imagine something that they can't see. And so with a kid, it's sort of the same thing. How do you get kids to understand where we come from and how evolution works and what have you? And the thing that I zeroed in on is, it started as body parts, right? Like fish have jaws, everything with a jaw evolved from fish, derived from fish. And so kids love body parts, right? Like they learn about their nose or their hands and, you know, what's a pinky. And that's a real natural part of being human, is sort of learning about yourself. And so the book started as learning about how your body or a child's body compares to a fish's body, and then the first amniote, sort of a reptile and a mammal. And the idea was you see how over time our ancestors have developed more and more features that are like us. And then I noodled on that for a while. And my big breakthrough about a year and a half ago was changing from being body parts to being actions. And so now, instead of talking about a fish having a jaw, it talks about fish can chomp and kids can chomp and fish can wiggle and kids can wiggle. And so it turns it into this fun interactive thing where the kids are hooting or grabbing and cuddling and all the sorts of things that our ancestors evolved to do sort of one step at a time.
Looking at going from homologous structures, a real fancy
yep,
way of saying that,
right,
to similar kind of behaviors. So incorporating both sort of the physical aspect of biology, looking
yep,
at morphology, looking at evolutionary behaviors. Really interesting, ingenious way of incorporating that at a level that's accessible to a five-year-old.
So we're tossing around words like homologous structures, which I'm not quite sure I understand the meaning of. And while I have my own reasons for thinking that even preschoolers should be introduced to the concept of evolution, what was your thought process about bringing this knowledge to preschoolers?
Well, you know, I think evolution is an amazing story, and it's a story that kids should know because if you look around the world, like what is a dog and what is a bird, if you understand where we all came from, you will understand your connection to that bird and your connection to that dog. And so I wanted to get the basics in really early so that kids, when they think about grabbing, they think, oh, grabbing, that's something that our ancestors evolved when they were primates, right? And so the book doesn't, you know, does not explain natural selection. That's a really tough concept. Lots of adults don't get it. So it really talks about common descent and homology. You know, that, like Becky said, that's exactly the most accessible evolutionary concept to children, is how, you know, our hand is like a foot or like a wing or what have you. So I know that this book can't really explain all of evolution to preschoolers, but it can give them a context for them to see the world in. And then as they learn more, you know, as they grow up and what have you, and they mature, they'll have a foundation on which to build a greater understanding of common descent of all human, all life.
That sounds straight out of your educational textbooks, Becky.
It does sound straight out of that. Actually, as someone with a background in literacy, I really like the idea of the readers and our children and the people, the adults sharing the book, being able to interact with the book. So if you say, hoot like an ape, can we do that too? Grab like, you know, something else, chomp like your fish.
Yep.
Did you consult any research or any educators or anything like that about specific things targeted for children's literacy or early literacy?
So, you know, mostly it was just me noodling on it for a long time. I did, once it was mostly done and I had a pretty good version, I did get some feedback from scientists and educators and parents. You know, I take some liberties, like there's, we'd never talk about the amphibians, and, you know, that's a step that kids are going to have to learn about eventually. But in terms of, you know, what you could package and put together for a kid and hold their attention, we simplified some things. And I did go back and forth about, like, what does hooting exactly mean? And how does that compare to squeaking? And there was a fellow named Eric Mickle from the National Center for Science Education, and he was really helpful in going over all that with me. And then in the back of the book, there's material for the parents. Like the story is super, super simple, but then the back talks about, well, you know, what was Grandmother Ape like? And when Grandmother Ape was hooting, what does that mean? And why did we pick hooting as the thing that Grandmother Ape did? And so forth. And so even adults who aren't that familiar with evolution can look at that material and then use it to help answer questions for their child or help their child understand more as they grow up.
That's really cool that you've provided a structure for building on knowledge obtained from within the story. You know, I've read books to kids and I've got follow-up questions a lot. And sometimes I'm like, I don't know.
Right.
I'm going to have to go look it up. And that's really helpful.
So did you have any test readers?
Yes. So I'm a game designer, so I know how important it is to play test. Yeah. And so, absolutely, I was not going to start the Kickstarter and what have you without the test readers. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot from, like, watching children interact with the book and listening to what parents had to say about their experiences. You know, it's a really simple story without a lot of words. And so, you know, even just one word change in there could have a really big impact. And I made a lot of little subtle changes that I think really helped bring the story out. And boy, it's so much better now thanks to those test readers.
So very few words, but really rich illustrations. Can you tell us a little bit about your collaboration with the illustrator? That's Karen Lewis.
Yeah, thanks for asking, because Karen has been great. So she's a friend of a friend, and I didn't realize that she was a children's science illustrator. Which is exactly what I needed, right?
Yeah. I feel like that's someone's dream job out there. I love science and I love art. Can I be a science illustrator for children?
Yeah, and then she happened to be in my social circle, and she was just the artist that I needed. And when she saw the manuscript, she realized she could really bring something to it, because there are artists that can do stuff for kids that's funny and goofy, and there are artists who can do sort of Smithsonian, you know, renditions of extinct species, but to be able to do something that really looks like an ancient fish, but is going to be attractive to a kid, that's a real trick. And boy, she hit it out of the park. It's the people love the art. I love the art. And, you know, she also brought a really tender touch to it by adding children to the illustrations. And so, grandmother ape has a little baby ape that she's playing with. And what we realized is we really had sort of a theme now. So you see grandmother reptile has a clutch of eggs, and grandmother mammal has a little litter of pups, or whatever you call the young of the first placental mammal. And then grandmother ape has a little kid, and grandmother human has a little family. And that's where the first father shows up, because really it was not until our recent ancestors that fathers started to actually provide for their kids and what have you. And so she added a whole element that it doesn't appear in the text, because the text, again, has to be super simple. But in the illustrations, you can see sort of the development of what turns out to be the human family. So in terms of content and in terms of style, she's just added so much to the book. And I'm really happy. And I think we'll probably work again on more books.
I was actually wondering, I mean, this one is sort of your first project, your first foray into children's literature. What kind of topics have you sort of explored beyond this?
So there's lots of stuff to do in evolution. I'd love to do a book about a universal human facial expressions, because kids can already sort of do them and recognize them. And that's sort of the first language we could speak before we had words was, you know, sticking out your tongue when something disgusted you or what have you. And so a book like that might help kids feel connected to, you know, our ancestors long ago who didn't have words yet. I could do an older book, Grandmother Fish is for preschoolers. So lots of like grade schools are not going to stock it as avidly as they might stock an evolution book for older kids. So that's a possibility. A number of people have independently asked me to do a book that would explain religion to their godless children.
Ouch.
Well, they get someone on the grade school says, are you saved? Or what church do you go to? And these, you know, little kids don't have any idea what's going on. And so, you know, if parents felt like they had something they could share with the kids and help them sort of understand something that's outside of their personal experience, So I don't have a plan yet for what's next, but I've got lots of possibilities.
I can see the obvious utility in a book like that for kids who are not in religious families, but that is a very narrow tightrope to walk.
It's pretty touchy. And with Grandmother Fish, you know, I tried really hard to, you know, show how marvelous and miraculous this story is and what have you without, you know, ever sort of trying to step on anybody's religious beliefs. Most of the people that, you know, understand evolution in this country are Christians. So, you know, there's nothing anti-religious in the book.
So as you might tell from my homespun studio here, I have a real appreciation for people who take a do-it-yourself attitude. And you decided rather than going through traditional publishing, you went to a Kickstarter project.
That's right.
What was the thinking behind that?
It's hard to get an evolution book for kids published to a regular publisher. I mean, it's hard to get any book published with a regular a kid's book, right? Everyone wants to do a kid's book. And then evolution is sort of a controversial topic, unfortunately. And my original idea was I was going to do it as an ebook because that would be cheaper. And I wanted to just self-publish it and, you know, just see what happened. But when I talked with people about the book, their eyes would light up and they would, you know, smile and get, you know, wow, evolution for preschoolers. And so I realized that this was a hot idea, that people were going to respond to it emotionally more strongly than I had imagined. And so if you've got a concept like that, then you want to do it on Kickstarter.
Well, it may be hard to sell that idea to a publisher. I mean, the first thing I saw when I looked at your Kickstarter page was that you were 3 times funded over your goal.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, the book is currently in electronic draft form. Now that it's you know, you've got it fully funded and things are going, what's your timeline for getting this actually published?
So we'll have a hardback in people's hands in April. And I think it's pretty easy to get things for sale online through Amazon and what have you. So my plan is in April, people will be able to order this book.
Very cool.
I mean, you can pre-order it right now, but it's, boy, when the book is done and people can actually see the hardback version, I think it's going to attract a lot of attention.
Now, you've gotten some really supportive reviews from educators and scientists and parents. Some prominent free thinkers even have chimed in.
I think I know where this is going.
Yeah. Speaking of controversy, can you tell us about some of the maybe less than charitable reviews you've gotten, say, from maybe religious literalists?
Yeah. So, Answers in Genesis has a blog where, yeah.
Oh, man, you got criticized by Answers. We haven't even reached that notoriety.
Yeah. I mean, I feel really good about that. Yeah.
I'm pretty jealous.
Yeah. I mean, like, they know who I am. It wasn't Ken Ham himself, but maybe when the book is done, he'll, you know. But I mean, the same thing that gets a lot of people excited about Evolution for Kids gets the other camp freaked out.
Yeah.
About Evolution for Kids, right?
That's just it. Is I was watching that video and I'm watching this book being read to kids. I'm like, this is great. Evolution is a really difficult thing to teach. It's great to get this foundation work. And then you can come back to it later and it gets people thinking in ideas.
Exactly.
And establishing the ideas. And then, because I read a lot of Christian propaganda, I had a context shift in my head. And I'm like, wow, people are going to think this is worse than Hitler.
Yeah, that's right.
And so it has been Answers in Genesis, and I imagine... It's wrong. Are they trying to refute you before they've even seen the book?
It's all about how, brainwashing these poor kids and sending them down the devil's path. You know, I mean, you could just imagine, right? And it's, you know, they look at the book and it's like, wow, it does lay out evolution in a really approachable way that even little kids can look at and go, wow, this makes a ton of sense. And now I understand why these animals are shaped that way and what have you, right? That's got to make some people's heads spin.
So we've got a lot of people in the free thought community who are obviously really into this.
Yeah.
I among them. And we've been talking about religious literalists, but those are not the only kind of religious people out there. And there are plenty of people out there who are religious and believe in evolution.
That's right.
Have you heard anything from those folks?
So I've got a friend who's Jewish, and she really likes the book precisely because there's nothing anti-religious about it, right?
Right.
It's all like... I want to be positive. I want to show how beautiful and marvelous and miraculous evolution is. And I can do that without ever having to, you know, look down my nose at anyone or say boo about anybody's beliefs.
So you'll actually be doing a public reading and sharing your book pretty soon.
That's
in
right.
The Seattle area. Can you tell us a little bit about that event?
Yeah. So, I mean, I heard you last week talking about it. It's the Darwin Day event on the 14th. It's at the 2100 building in Mount Baker neighborhood. And it's an annual celebration of Charles Darwin and everything related to that. So my daughter and I are going to be there. She's actually going to be reading the book to kids. And she's better with kids than I am. And I'm going to be leading the kids in an evolution dance, which is sort of like the hokey pokey, but you evolve your limbs one at a time. And and then, of course, it's a much bigger event as well. There's a Camp Quest, sort of Taste of Camp Quest program for kids ages 5 and up. And
that's where I usually am hanging out, upstairs in the camp room. So I think the past 5 years or so, I've been missing the festivities down in the big room.
Yeah, Becky's other job, she's usually one of the people working on Darwin Day. I'm usually not because it's a Sunday and I'm here. But
this year's Saturday.
So I may actually get to make it this time.
Yeah, and that sounds great.
I've been to Darwin Day a few times and it's really fantastic. So you've used the word miraculous.
Yeah.
A couple times here.
And that's right.
I can already hear the emails coming in. Why do you use the word miraculous? I kind of like it, but what makes you choose that word here?
Right. I mean, when we talk about something being miraculous, we're talking about an actual feeling that humans have in response to something. Wow, that was miraculous. And that feeling is totally real.
Yeah.
And some people... like Oprah, think that if you're an atheist, you must not be able to stand in awe in the face of nature because you don't think anything's miraculous. Well, I don't know. Evolution's pretty miraculous. It's pretty amazing. It's you know, and it's sort of every one of us who's alive today is like a one in a, you know, billion, million, trillion chance, right? Like, we're the ancestors of the few fish who actually survived to have kids that survived to have kids that survived to have kids. And the, you know, of all the animals in the world, almost all of them are eaten or killed somehow before they can reproduce. Or if they reproduce, all their kids are killed. And we are those you know, in every generation, we've been, our ancestors have been like one in 100, one in 20, one in 1,000, depending on how many eggs got laid by that, at that level of development. Like, a fish lay hundreds of eggs or thousands of eggs in their lifetime, and on average, only two of those are going to survive, roughly. So that's whatever. That's miraculous that we're here. Like, we're the, you know, the one in a million odds. So anyway, I like taking those phrases that religious people want to claim as their own, as if the feeling that something is miraculous belongs to them. I think it belongs to people, to humans.
I want to go back, if I can, for a moment to finally when we get to humans in the story. Yep. You talked about how your illustrator, Karen, decided to have sort of a family. So yep. Beyond just the organism and, yep. and the organism's children or young, we have a whole family, father. How did Karen or you work together to decide what the humans should look like? Because humans come in a lot of different shapes, colors, clothing, all sorts of things like that.
Yeah. So, boy, that was a very daunting question, and one that I worried about from the very beginning of the book. And our solution is you've got sort of a almost non-ethnic family. Like, they, you know, they're medium brown, and their facial features are not distinctly Asian or European or African or what have you. And, you know, we just wanted images that the most people in the world could relate to. Because, you know, that's grandmother human. Those are the people from whom we are all descended. Like, I think if this were a scientific piece, I think probably those, you know, those first humans that lived in Africa on the savannas were probably very dark skinned. But we wanted to, like, we didn't want to give little white kids the idea that blacks are some lower level of evolution or what have you. It's a very touchy topic. If you portray them as white, that's wrong. And yeah. It makes whites seem like they're the real humans and everyone else is, you know, a branch off of being white. If you make them black, then that's wrong because it makes them seem like, well, you know, we used to be primitive and we were black, but now we're advanced and we're white. And so it's very tricky. So we just picked something sort of, you know, in the middle. And, you know, if you look at our fish on the cover, you know, I don't think those early fish were such, you know, nice red and orange colors and really bright and vibrant. You know, we're taking some liberties. It's a kid's book.
I think looking at the picture, what I would say might be trans-ethnic or, you know,
That's a good way to think about it, right? Yeah.
But I really like the idea of any child being able to very distinctly identify that's human, that's my ancestors, that's my family right
there. That's right. So. And then there's a two-page spread at the very end where you finally see modern-day humans. And you're going to see a pretty good variety of sort of ethnic or racial images.
I really do want have to say, we talked about this earlier in the interview, but I like the portrayal of families in this book, because people tend to talk about evolution. They talk about survival of the fittest,
right.
And they make it sound like a monster truck rally,
right? Nature, red in tooth and claw, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And to say that no, actually, raising families and compassion and all of that is also part of what has brought us here today,
right.
I think
that's
an important story. So if people would like to find out, find more about this book or find out more about you, where would I send them?
So grandmotherfish.com is our official website. And then I'm Jonathan Tweet. I've got a presence on Twitter and Google and Facebook. Google Plus, and, you know, I'm sort of a geek. So Google Plus is my number one spot. You can find me there.
Google Plus is where I go hide.
But, you know, you Google grandmother fish, that's not a phrase that occurs very often in the English language, and so you can find us really easy that way.
Jonathan Tweet has been a professional game designer for over 25 years, working on games such as Dungeons & Dragons and Magic the Gathering. He's been working on Grandmother Fish, a book designed to teach the concept of evolution to preschoolers. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
You're listening to Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. When we come back from the break, we're going to go back to news of the week and other interesting stuff.
Seattle Atheists and Camp Quest Northwest are teaming up to celebrate with a day of games and interactive science crafts, see fossils older than the dinosaurs. Teens and adults, test your knowledge by competing in Evolution Jeopardy. Kids get their very own science activity room. Go to meetup.com/Seattle Atheists for more information and to register your kids.
Darwin Day 2015 at the 2100 building in Seattle on Saturday, February 14th at 1 p.m. Go to seattleatheists.org for details.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
Imagine tropical waters, warm sandy beaches, friendly people, incredible weather. The English-speaking Caribbean island nation of St. Lucia awaits. Don Summers and his team at Professional Realty Group are ready to assist you. Whether you're looking for an investment, a place to retire, or a killer vacation property, St. Lucia has homes in all price ranges starting at $110,000. Call Don at 780-237-4718 and check out dndrealty.ca.
Hey, podcast listeners.
Did you know that Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey is a radio show?
Radio waves and everything.
If you know of a radio station that could benefit from Ask an Atheist in your area, let us know.
And don't forget to let the station know you'd love to hear us.
So to help us humanize atheists in mass media, email us at stations@askanatheist.tv.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist with me, Sam Mulvey, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Joining me again in this segment is Becky. How are you?
I'm still doing well, Sam.
So there's been something we've been kind of remiss in talking about on the show, but we are planning to do a lot more with it, and that's the subject of measles. There is a record measles outbreak in the United States right now that, if I'm hearing properly, began at a, well, didn't begin at a Disneyland, but it basically got the spin up to epidemic proportions from a bunch of unvaccinated people visiting Disneyland. Correct, Becky?
Yes. The biggest outbreak happened through Disneyland, but measles is becoming increasingly common throughout the United States for various reasons. And the biggest one is people that do not have vaccinations, and people that don't have vaccinations because they opt out, because they are too young to be vaccinated, yeah, or because of medical reasons.
Five infants from a KinderCare learning center in Palatine, Illinois, have been diagnosed with measles. Unvaccinated children at the KinderCare and two nearby elementary schools are being excluded from school for 21 days. The outbreak source is unclear, but may stem from an infected Cook County adult who visited public places. Infants have no immune protection from measles until their first vaccination, typically administered at 12 to 15 months. About 1 in 12 children nationwide aren't receiving their vaccines on schedule, and an increasing number of parents are opting out of vaccinations due to religious or personal beliefs. This is emblematic of what it looks like. This is where herd immunity. I'm certain if you're one of those morons who believes that vaccinations somehow give you autism, you've heard this before. But herd immunity actually works. It does a thing, and this is what happens when you don't. If I remember properly, we were on our way to eradicating measles at one point, weren't we?
We were looking at measles no longer being endemic to the United States. And you know, it really takes about 92 to 95%, is my understanding, of the population to be vaccinated in order for, you know, the disease basically not to spread anymore. It's in an infected individual, and if it can't hop to someone else, that little outbreak just, you know, kind of dies out.
And moron is not a word I use lightly in this case. There are people who are just ignorant and uneducated, and once they have education about something, they make better decisions. But then you have this population of people who are trying to basically promulgate and enforce a level of ignorance and enforce misunderstandings of how vaccines work. And those are the people I'm directly calling morons here.
The other thing that's really alarming to me is people that will, in news reports, in their own blogs, in discussions, acknowledge Well, I rely on everyone else being vaccinated, and I just don't want to vaccinate my own kids. I understand that they're unlikely to get it because everyone else is vaccinated.
Except that doesn't work when you start having 10, 15, 20% of the population who thinks that way.
We have Vashon Island nearby that has a huge number of children at some elementary schools. 50% at some of the elementary schools or daycares that do not have basic childhood vaccines on schedule. And this one, Sam, actually hits a little home, close to home for you, right?
Palatine, Illinois is where I'm from. That is actually my hometown. But closer to here, a measles case in King County was linked to a Brazilian traveler visiting Seattle while contagious. The traveler, who was unvaccinated, was traced to a hotel downtown in SeaTac Airport. A King County infant was infected, which is the third case in the state so far this year. There seems to be no connection between this case and the recent outbreak at Disneyland. So you have it here, you have it in Palatine, Illinois. There are a lot of interesting things about this modern anti-vaccination movement, and that is it transcends political boundaries. You have this enforced ignorance on both sides of the political spectrum. You've got the hippy-dippy look at it, which is, I don't want chemicals going into my children because I have no idea what chemicals are. And then you've got the, they're taking away our precious bodily fluids of the right. And the end result is the same, and that's dead kids. That's where this ends. That is the last station on this train line. Is this really a train you want to be on? And, you know, the fact of the matter is, this is clearly not a train that a lot of people want to be on, because a lot of folks who I used to see on Facebook talking a big game about anti-vax, which is something I follow on social media, suddenly changing their tune now that there's social pressure.
Are you seeing people change?
A little bit. Starting to.
There are some interesting studies by a researcher, Nyhan, that really shows that sometimes with the pushback, you get a backfire effect where people will dig in more deeply to their convictions that they don't need vaccinations, or fighting off a disease naturally is better.
But I think that's true when the anti-vaccination thing is a core part of your identity. If it's something that's really important to you, you're going to dig in no matter what. Your mind isn't going to change. But these people influence other people. And it's these other groups of people who don't really see it as a core value that are starting to shift. It's not the people who are running the anti-vaccination pages who are changing their mind. It's the people around them that I'm beginning to see a change in attitude as the death toll increases.
And as we see, you know what?
Or as the illness toll.
The illness, yeah. Maybe it's a deeper core value for health of children and immunocompromised people.
Right.
I mean, when you have someone that's vulnerable medically, it's really hard to say, I'm going to not protect them. You know, we require our medical professionals to wear gloves to protect both the medical professional and their patients.
Yeah, this is a conversation I was having with some people, and some thoughts that I've been having is that we have a very, you know, we value the ability to do whatever the heck you want in the United States. We do. And that's a value I share. And in a perfect world, I'd say there's no medical procedure you should be forced to undergo. There just shouldn't be. That's the way I would prefer it. If I ruled the world and if I had control over physics itself, that's what I would set up.
Does biology have something different in mind?
Apparently, biology has something different in mind. And are we at the point now where we may want to consider some sort of rules or some sort of, I don't know, consequences for not vaccinating? But it's not any, like in the United States, we don't often have a lot of positive requirements for being a citizen or not being arrested or not being in trouble. We generally focus on the don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other thing. Very rarely is it must do this, must do that, outside of things like paying taxes. Until you get to driving. Which is what I was thinking of. And this is a metaphor that I was using, but it turns out other people have thought of this too and have done a little bit more extensive. But we have a positive requirement to use brakes in a car. You know, we need to use the accelerator to make the car go. If we don't want to kill people, we have to use the brakes. That's a positive requirement.
That protects the driver and the passengers of the car itself and those around us.
Yeah. And the fact of the matter is vaccination is a safety concern, and it is a public safety concern. It's a public health concern. I've had so many conversations with anti-vaxxers on social media where they go, well, I got a vaccination and I had an allergic reaction, which is why nobody should take it. And I said, actually, no, you have an allergy to these things, so you shouldn't be taking it, but I should, so that you don't get exposed to the disease. I think as someone who has an allergic reaction to vaccinations, you should be advocating harder for other people to get vaccinations so you don't get sick. Because there are allergic reactions. This is why herd immunity is important, is to protect the people who are too young, too old, or have these reactions, these vaccinations, in order to keep them safe as well. This is about keeping everybody safe, everybody alive, and giving everybody a chance at happiness.
I absolutely agree with you, Sam. And I think the way that this intersects with, you know, people, most people who are atheists, is a really interesting sort of way, because when you apply the principles of skepticism that many people apply to a belief in a deity, you'll see that that also helps sort of suss out the details regarding all kinds of things. And in this case, vaccinations, basic inoculations that protect us and, yeah, and protect our society. And, you know, for many atheists that operate from a humanistic perspective, you know, we value human life. We value the dignity of individuals. And when you have these vulnerable individuals, it's really important to protect them.
Right. And, you know, I have a strong case of the feels on this, because death and debilitation born out of ignorance is a thing that gets to me. It's a thing that makes me angry. It's a thing that makes me puts me at my less than polite, I should say.
It's a thing that is easily preventable.
And it's, but that's the thing. When it's born out of ignorance, it's almost always easily preventable. All you had to do was fix the ignorance at some point ahead of time and you would have been fine. And so don't listen to me. Don't, you know, feel free to get angry at my insensitivity to your political agenda, but don't listen to me. Listen to experts. Listen to medical experts. Listen to the last 150 years of medical history. Look at the diseases that have been been eradicated. Look at the general improvement of quality of life in worlds that in countries and in parts of the world that do regular vaccinations. The history, the science, everything is obvious once you get out of this little weird suburb where they have like two or three discredited studies, and they weigh that against tons and tons and tons of history, of science, of evidence that completely blows this autism link or this mercury link or this cancer link or this precious bodily fluid link completely out of the water. Don't listen to me. Don't even listen to this. It may be entertaining, but it's not educational. Go get educated.
I couldn't say it any better, any more firmly. Yeah, go for it. I mean, when we're looking at in public places, we all interact with public, everyone. I mean, unless you live on your own land and do not interact physically with the outside world, you're going to be coming into contact with people. And if you're going to be doing that, you're going to be influencing people. And in my view, you have a responsibility for the way you interact with people.
And I have an additional message for those of us on the side of right here, on the side of science and evidence and stuff like that, is if you run into somebody who was an anti-vaxxer and looked at the science and changed their mind and looked at the overwhelming evidence and the overwhelming proof and changed their mind, welcome them. Don't ridicule them. This is greater than your desire to be right, because everybody wants to be right. I mean, I want to be right. Look at me. I'm on talk radio. That's what this is about. But when we meet somebody who actually goes for the evidence, who actually, even if they have these closely held beliefs, and they go for the evidence, and they change their mind, and this, to me, this is more important than religion. This is about saving lives. Welcome these people. These are your friends. These are your allies. You don't need to use this for a cheap one-up on your personality.
I had recently, in the past year, had the experience of working with a young woman who had a baby, and she was 18, and her family members were very, very skeptical and scared of vaccines, of modern medicine, and of doctors.
Yeah.
And she, as an 18-year-old woman, said, I'm taking my baby for her shots. And she said, Mom, this is your old thinking. This is, you know, old ways of thinking about things. And her mom said, fine, but I'm not accompanying you to the doctor with your baby. And so she, as a young mother, took her baby by herself, said it was one of the hardest things that she could do. But it said that it was, beyond having a baby, the first thing that made her feel like a grown up.
Wow.
it was a very powerful moment, and yeah. I happen to be in the position of not ever, you know, being in the position of ridiculing this young woman that I was working with.
Yeah.
But yes, having that welcoming attitude and saying, you know, I respect your your work to protect your family, your children, yourselves, and those around us.
And those are the people we have to support. Not everybody is a fascist or a hippie or, you know, a cast member of Dr. Strangelove. Sometimes people are just miseducated, and we should take that opportunity to educate them rather than ridicule them. And maybe this is just as much to myself as to anybody else. But that's all the time we've got for today. My name is Sam. Joining me was Becky. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Jonathan Tweet. I'd like to thank our writer, Dave Brulette. You can go to askanatheist.tv. You can leave us a voicemail at questions@askanatheist.tv. You can leave us a voicemail at 844-753-7842. Toll free nationwide. If you're on the podcast feed, expect to hear from us before the end of the week about, I don't know, Darwin Day, this whole E Pluribus Unum thing. Who knows? Otherwise, see you guys next week.